for this May 18th, this is Washington Today on C-SPAN Radio. I'm Steve Scully. We're glad you're with us. And here are some of your Tuesday headlines. The House Republican leader, Kevin McCarthy, announcing today that he is opposed to the deal that would form a 9/11-style bipartisan commission to investigate the insurrection on January 6th. We'll have the details just ahead. The director of the CDC announcing today revised COVID guidance is coming for businesses, schools, higher education, and summer camps. This after the agency announced last week that fully vaccinated people no longer need to wear a mask in most cases indoors and outdoors. It also comes with news today that 60% of adults now have received at least one dose of the COVID-19 vaccine. Meanwhile, Home Depot and Best Buy joining what is a growing list of national retailers easing their mask policies in light of these new CDC guidance. And India reporting a single-day record of just over 4,300 COVID deaths, though daily cases have dipped below 300,000 for the first time in weeks. Police say a rocket launch from Gaza killing two people in Israel today, hours after Israeli airstrikes destroyed a six-story building that housed bookstores and an educational center. Overnight, dozens of Israeli jets launching more than 100 missiles into Gaza, targeting the tunnel network used by Hamas. That, of course, is the militant group that controls the Palestinian territory. Just some of the stories shaping Washington today. It's all ahead here on C-SPAN Radio. And we begin on Capitol Hill, where the House Republican leader today formally voicing his opposition to legislation to create a bipartisan commission to investigate the attacks inside the U.S. Capitol on January 6th. In a lengthy statement a day before the House was set to vote on the measure, Representative Kevin McCarthy of California criticizing the process, the negotiations, and said the multiple investigations into the riot already exist. Now, an agreement was announced last Friday, the result of lengthy negotiations between the top Democrat and Republican on the House Homeland Security Committee. That would be Representative Benny Thompson from Mississippi and Representative John Katko from New York. Now, the statement from Leader McCarthy reads in part, quote, "Given the political misdirections that have marred this process, given the now duplicative and potentially counterproductive nature of this effort, and given the Speaker's short-sighted scope that does not examine interrelated forms of political violence in America, I cannot support this legislation." Well, reacting to that announcement from Leader McCarthy, the chair of the House Democratic Caucus, Congressman Hakeem Jeffries of New York.
It seems reasonable that America should have a bipartisan commission to ascertain the truth and present it to the American people. It's hard to take Kevin McCarthy seriously at this point. It's just hard. He can't take yes for an answer. This is a bipartisan agreement negotiated by Democratic Chairman Benny Thompson and Republican ranking member John Katko. They raised several issues in terms of the discussions that have been occurring at the outset as critical ones important to the Republican conference. They raised the issue of makeup, and the original composition had presidential appointments, as has been the case in other instances. But because that appointment or series of appointments would be made by President Joe Biden, they objected. We agreed to make the commission evenly appointed by the legislative leaders. Five Democratic appointments, five Republican appointments. Kevin McCarthy also objected to there being subpoena power vested solely in the chair of the commission, when that, in fact, is the practice here in the United States Congress. But in the interest of finding common ground, we agreed to the fact that both the chair appointed by the Democratic legislative leaders and the vice chair appointed by the Republican legislative leaders needed to come together in order for any subpoena to be issued. I don't know what Kevin McCarthy is afraid of.
That from Hakeem Jeffries. He is the chair of the House Democratic Caucus. We did not hear on camera the comments by Leader McCarthy, but his statement voicing his opposition to this 9/11 style commission looking into the events on January 6th. Meanwhile, the Senate Republican leader, Mitch McConnell, said after a closed door conference meeting with his Senate Republicans that he is, quote, willing to listen to the arguments for the commission, but again insisting that it be evenly divided between the two political parties, even at the staff level. And there is this from a CNN interview, Alaska's Republican Senator Lisa Murkowski announcing that former President Trump should testify if the commission is formed to conduct a formal investigation.
I will look to what he has stated in terms of how broad it needs to be. If you're really making this a very broad brush approach, it might be difficult to really get value from a specific type of commission. But again, I think this is something where you need to look closely to the details and how it's configured.
Do you think former President Trump should talk to this commission to detail what was happening on that day?
If you put together a commission that is focused on the events of January 6th, I think he's obviously a very key individual.
That from Republican Senator Lisa Murkowski and a question from Manu Raju of CNN. The House Rules Committee taking up the issue of this January 6th commission. The chair of the Rules Committee, Congressman Jim McGovern, Democrat of Massachusetts.
This was not a normal tourist visit, as one of my Republican colleagues recently claimed. The truth matters, especially when something as fundamental as our democracy is at stake. We need to get to the bottom of exactly what happened and make sure that it never, ever happens again. H.R. 3233 will establish a commission to investigate the January 6th attacks. It's designed after the 9/11 commission and will be led by experts, not politicians. I'm glad that the chairman and ranking member of the Homeland Security Committee reached a bipartisan deal to finally make this commission a reality. I'm especially pleased that it focused solely on what happened on January 6th and not on other unrelated witch hunts that some of my Republican colleagues have called for. I look forward to its report at the end of the year, but make no mistake, we need to act now to respond to what we've learned so far and to support a demoralized Capitol Police that is stretched way too thin. H.R. 3237 will provide $1.9 billion to secure the safety of the Capitol, protect facilities, members, employees, and visitors going forward, and it would provide for safe and healthy congressional operations. Already, we have received the Capitol Security Review and discussed this matter at a bipartisan briefing, 12 subcommittee hearings, and countless conversations with members and experts. I pray that we never, ever see another day like January 6th. But that's not enough. We need to follow the facts and to act to not only protect the Capitol and those that walk its halls, but our very democracy.
And that from Congressman Jim McGovern, Democrat of Massachusetts. He chairs the House Rules Committee. And again, look for more of the debate on the House floor tomorrow and in the days ahead. We made reference earlier to John Katko, Republican congressman from upstate New York. He is the ranking member on the committee that formed this bipartisan deal that was formally announced on Friday. Here's more with the New York Republican.
Modeled after the 9/11 Commission, this bill creates a 10-member panel with five commissioners appointed by each party and equal subpoena authority. Appointed commissioners who cannot be current government employees must have significant experience in at least two of the following areas: government service, law enforcement, civil rights, civil liberties and privacy, the armed forces, intelligence, counterterrorism, cybersecurity, technology, and law. It has nothing to do with which party you're in. It has to do with your qualifications. The commission's report, which must be agreed upon by a majority of commissioners, will include findings and recommendations to prevent future attacks on our democratic institutions and improve the security of the Capitol. The December 2020 deadline allows for a much shorter timeline than originally proposed, and for good reason. The American people and the Capitol Police deserve answers and improvements as soon as possible to ensure nothing like this ever happens again. As I have called for since the days just after the attack, an independent 9/11 style review is critical for removing the politics surrounding January 6th. We all know there's a lot of politics surrounding January 6th. And for focusing solely on the facts and circumstances of the security breach at the Capitol, as well as other instances of violence relevant to such a review. I can't state this more plainly enough. This is about facts. It's not about partisan politics. It's about making the Capitol Police complex stronger. It's about making the Capitol safer. It's about making the Capitol Police Department our officers, which by admission is a very dysfunctional group right now with 92% of their members having no confidence in their leadership, going to make them better. We have to make them better. We owe it to the line people who risk their lives to protect us every single day.
Olivia Biebers is a congressional reporter for Politico, and she is one of the co-authors of the newsletter Huddle, joining us on the phone here in Washington. First, let's begin with the news of Leader Kevin McCarthy. Where do things stand tonight with this commission?
A lot of things are in flux, Steve. So when the GOP leader said that he does not support the commission, it sent a whole wave of, okay, is that going to change how some Republicans previously thought they were going to vote for the bill, especially those who are on the fence? Even asking around today after his comments, some members are telling me I don't know how they're going to vote, which might also just be, you know, them trying to not show their cards about how they plan to vote. But we're also starting to get a little bit of rumbling that, you know, members aren't entirely happy that McCarthy threw his deputy, Congressman John Katko of New York, under the bus. He had tasked Katko with working with House Democrats to reach a deal on the bipartisan commission. And when Katko said that they had come to an agreement, Democrats had met almost all their demands, he basically was thrown under the bus. And so while they initially were pretending like there were no hard feelings, I certainly have some sources suggesting that might not be the case.
Well, let me follow up on that point, because one of the issues we've been hearing from Republicans is that they want to expand this beyond January 6th. Speaker Pelosi, of course, insisting it must be just about January 6th. So explain what that debate is all about.
So, you know, Republicans are trying to make it so that they can investigate what they described as other kind of violence. Like they saw the racial protests over the summer in 2020. And for Democrats, they're saying that can be something else, but we're focusing on January 6th. So that has been a point that they've been trying to make. But I would say, you know, the goalposts have been moving for creating this commission. And basically, Steve, I would say you have to think of it in terms of what is McCarthy's goal, right? He doesn't want to be subpoenaed. He doesn't want to be going against Trump. And he has this group of the House Freedom Caucus that he doesn't want to go up against, because if he wins back the majority, he needs their support. And so basically supporting a commission examining Trump's actions on that day is not the way to go about it. So that is certainly, you know, a huge part to keep in mind as, you know, he's making these demands. He had a list of demands in February where basically, you know, Democrats have met him on those points. And so they say, you know, you never really planned to agree with us anyway.
If there is a commission, one of the stories that we saw this morning in the huddle, lawmakers, quote, fielding requests from hopeful January 6th commissioners. You've been talking to a lot of lawmakers, Democrats and Republicans, and those who might want to be on the commission. Can you explain?
So it seems like quite a few members are being lobbied by outside officials to put their names forward to be a member of the commission. It would be high profile. It would be a way for members who are in retirement to kind of come back and have this new role that everyone is watching. But, you know, Jim Banks, he is the chairman of the Republican Study Committee. He put forward Susan Brooks, who is a former member from his same state. I heard Pete Hoekstra, who served as Trump's ambassador to the Netherlands, who I can't imagine Democrats would get behind. There's Fiona Hill, who served as an impeachment witness during Trump's first Senate impeachment trial over his contacts with Ukraine. And one name that I heard repeatedly, both from Democrats and Republicans, including Congresswoman Cheney, Congressman Kinzinger, and Congressman Tom Malinowski of New Jersey, is a Democrat. They all were voicing support for Denver Riggleman, who is a former intelligence official, and he specializes in disinformation. He lost this last cycle, and they're all thinking that he would be a good member. And Denver Riggleman is certainly on board with that idea.
As this story continues to unfold, we'll follow your reporting at Politico.com. Olivia Beavers, here in Washington, thank you for being with us.
Thanks, Steve.
On Wall Street, the market's losing ground. The Dow is off by 267 points, the NASDAQ down 75, and the S&P dropping 35.5 points. Meanwhile, the Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen is calling for business leaders to pay higher taxes to support government stimulus spending and also backing stronger labor unions as well as lowering barriers to foreign competition. She did so in a speech to the U.S. Chamber of Commerce. The former Fed Secretary, now Treasury Secretary in the Biden administration, again outlining the White House proposal to raise taxes on corporations and to the highest 1% earners as part of a plan to spend money on infrastructure and other Biden administration programs. The White House is also seeking what they're calling a global corporate minimum tax. That, by the way, is an effort to stop companies from relocating their bases to avoid higher taxes at home. The CDC director, Dr. Rochelle Walensky, today again defending the agency's decision to tell people who are fully vaccinated that they can go without a mask. Meanwhile, state and local officials, along with businesses, are grappling with the question of whether to follow suit, although some businesses, including Home Depot and Best Buy, beginning to ease those restrictions. And during a virtual briefing today with White House reporters, she also explained why the COVID-19 cases continues to decline nationwide.
Yesterday, CDC reported 17,724 new cases of COVID-19, the lowest daily case numbers since June 2020. The seven-day average of hospital admissions is 3,500. Again, a positive sign with another back-to-back decrease of almost 18% from the prior seven-day period. And seven-day average daily deaths have also declined to a new low of 546 per day. The last time our seven-day average was this low was in March 2020, essentially since the pandemic began in large parts of the United States. The past week has been a big week with progress and milestones that set us on a path out of this pandemic. We should all have cautious optimism. Cases have continued to decrease and have not been this low since spring of last year. Hospital admissions are down, deaths are down, and we are vaccinating between 1.5 million and 2 million people per day. And we are now working with governors and local leaders who are looking at their case transmission rates and vaccination rates to make informed decisions about how to safely get back to the activities we have lost during this pandemic. This was never going to be easy, but we will do the hard work together and get through this together. Last week, FDA authorized and CDC recommended use of the Pfizer vaccine for adolescents. In less than 1 week, we have vaccinated more than 600,000 12 to 15-year-olds. And in total, more than 4.1 million adolescents aged 12 to 17 have been vaccinated so far. My own son was one of them. Yesterday, we had a landmark day. As the president announced, more than 60% of people 18 years and older have received at least one vaccine dose. We need to continue to ensure vaccination coverage is uniform across the country. This will require us to meet people where they are, to listen to their concerns, and to help people make informed decisions about vaccination.
That update, part of a virtual news conference with the CDC director, Dr. Rochelle Walensky. Meanwhile, the House today passing a bill that aims to stem a spike in hate crimes against Asian Americans during this coronavirus pandemic. Approval will now send the measure to the president's desk for his signature. The bill, by the way, did pass the Senate last month. The only one vote in opposition came from Republican Senator Josh Hawley. The COVID-19 Hate Crimes Act would direct the Justice Department to expedite review of hate crimes related to the pandemic. The measure also seeks to give local law enforcement officials more resources to track the incidents. From the House floor, Democratic Representative Grace Meng.
For over a year, against the backdrop of a raging COVID-19 virus and an economic crisis, Asian Americans have been fighting an additional pandemic, the virus of hate and bigotry. Over 6,600 incidents of physical, verbal, and online attacks against those of Asian descent have been reported since March 2020. Of these, about two-thirds were reported by women. Throughout this pandemic, over 2 million Asian Americans served our nation as frontline workers, including those in healthcare. And yet some of these same Asian Americans became victims of hate as they were commuting to or from work. Children as young as my two boys have been attacked in playgrounds in their own neighborhoods across the country in every single state. Elderly are being assaulted, tragically resulting in deaths. And this culminated in the worst kind of tragedy with the mass shootings in Atlanta. We need to address this hate once and for all. That's why I introduced the COVID-19 Hate Crimes Act. I am proud the Senate companion bill, led by Senator Hirono, passed in the Senate last month with resounding bipartisan support, 94-1. The COVID-19 Hate Crimes Act is a necessary step to confront the second pandemic of racism and discrimination. We cannot mend what we do not measure. I strongly urge my colleagues to stand with me and vote for the passage of this bill. I yield back.
Representative Meng, just part of the debate earlier today on the House floor on a bill that would deal with the rise in hate crimes against Asian Americans. The measure did pass 364-62. Those 62 no votes came from Republicans. Also from the House floor, one of those no votes, Ohio Republican Congressman Jim Jordan.
Madam Speaker, we all condemn violence against people based on their race. In America, no one should live in fear that they will be a victim of a crime based on their beliefs, the color of their skin, or the country in which they were born. We've seen reports of violence directed at Asian Americans increase recently in some places around our country. While the perpetrators of these violent acts must be held accountable, we have serious concerns about some aspects of this legislation and the process behind moving it forward. For instance, the legislation sets up ambiguous hotlines for people to report anything they find troubling. These hotlines are separate from traditional law enforcement reporting mechanisms, such as calling 911 or your local police department's non-emergency line. And they could enable anyone to report anything that that individual may find offensive. All crimes should be reported, investigated by law enforcement, and prosecuted. Telling the public that criminal complaints shouldn't be reported to law enforcement, but instead to a new unrelated state office, creates unnecessary confusion and could harm public safety. In addition, this bill establishes online reporting for complaints about, quote, incidents. But of course, the bill doesn't specify what an incident is. No definition at all. This means essentially that we are asking state governments to act as speech police and creates a precedent that could extend to any manner of things someone may deem offensive. We were hopeful that there could be a meaningful discussion and input on this bill, but the chairman pulled the bill from our scheduled markup in Judiciary Committee last month, preventing Republicans from offering any amendments. Republicans had a number that we would have ensured that a number of amendments that would have ensured that the reporting hotlines were focused on actual criminal conduct and not random citizen complaints. Finally, it's important to note that the Democrats have attempted to blame President Trump for this rise in violence against Asian Americans. But the facts tell an entirely different story.
And that's from Congressman Jim Jordan, a Republican of Ohio. Again, the legislation did pass. It marks essentially the most concrete action that Congress has taken so far to respond what has been a rise in violence and harassment directed toward Asian Americans since the pandemic started last year. It follows an increase in rhetoric aimed at Asian Americans towards China in particular over the origins of COVID-19. You're listening to Washington Today. And welcome back to Washington Today for this Tuesday. Here are some of your other headlines. In Elizabeth City, North Carolina, the county's district attorney announcing today that no deputies will face criminal charges in the killing of Andrew Brown Jr. after a prosecutor saying that the shooting in North Carolina last month was justified, saying while tragic, it was justified because of his actions. Andrew Brown was shot in his vehicle April 21st by sheriff's deputies. They were serving an arrest warrant on felony drug charges. And Politico.com is reporting that a Republican-led revolt over masks is brewing inside the House of Representatives as Capitol Hill continues to wrestle with how and when to return to pre-pandemic routines. Congressman Brian Mast of Florida stood up during today's GOP conference meeting, telling his colleagues, quote, he is done wearing masks and will refuse to wear them on the House floor going forward, even if it means being fined. That, according to multiple sources in the room, the story at Politico.com. President Biden traveling to a Ford Motor plant in Michigan today to highlight the need to invest in electric vehicles. This as the White House continues to look to gain support for the president's $2.3 trillion tax and spending plan, which includes billions to transform the American auto industry. The president was at Ford's Electric Vehicle Center in Dearborn. That's where the company is producing its new electric F-150 Lightning pickup. The truck's official launch, by the way, is tomorrow. Here's President Biden.
And there is another thing we have in our playbook that's going to outcompete other nations. The biggest secret we have, the American worker. Not a joke. They're the finest workforce in the world. It's our ace in that deck. Now, I know many of you watching at home are like the folks I grew up with in Scranton and in Claymont, Delaware. They feel left out, left behind. In an economy, in an industry that's rapidly changing. I understand it. I really do. But we will leave no one behind. Nearly 90% of the jobs created in my American Jobs Plan do not require a bachelor's degree. 75% don't require an associate's degree. We're going to be working with companies and community colleges and technical schools and union-led apprentice and training programs to make sure that American workers will be prepared to compete with anyone in the world, just like Ford does with its workforce training center here in Dearborn. And when we invest in our infrastructure, we're going to buy American products, materials, services from American businesses made in America. And we'll do everything in our power to encourage and protect the right of workers to unionize and collectively bargain.
The president at a Ford Motor electric plant in Dearborn, Michigan. And by the way, his plan, if approved, would include about $174 billion in federal investments for electric vehicles. The Senate Health, Education, Labor, and Pensions Committee held a hearing on the president's Family Security Act. The Democratic proposal would give a child allowance of $250 a month for school-aged children and up to $350 a month for those who are younger, who are infants, with an annual cap of $1,250, depending on whether you qualify based on your earnings. But one of the questions, of course, is how to pay for it. Vicki Shabo is with the New America Foundation. She is a senior fellow on family and gender equity issues. Here is that exchange with her and Republican Senator Bill Cassidy of Louisiana.
But I gather that you would finance your paid leave with a payroll tax. Now, what we've seen in some states is that, say, Google in California is providing a benefit. And when California comes in the state and provides a benefit, all Google does is pull back upon their contribution and allows the state to pick up that which formerly Google paid for. On net, the beneficiary doesn't get any more money. It's just that that which was formerly paid by a Fortune 10 company is now being paid by taxpayers. Any thoughts about that?
Yes, I'm so glad you asked the question, Senator Cassidy. I know this has been a concern for you. I think the evidence overwhelmingly shows that in states that have adopted paid leave programs, we haven't seen the benefits be reduced. In fact, Google, Facebook, the tech giants that have led on paid leave benefits haven't reduced their offerings.
Does the beneficiary get the state plus what they were formerly getting from the business? Or is it that
I believe Google and Facebook,
reduced.
Right, I think they self-insure, actually, so they don't draw on the state program at all.
What I've been told by others in another committee hearing, that there is a reduction in the amount that the company puts up, subtracted by the amount that the employee would receive from the state program. Are you saying that's not true or that you're not sure about that?
Well, we should look into that, and I can get back to you on it.
Vicky Schabo is with the New America Foundation, and that's Republican Senator Bill Cassidy, the exchange at the Senate Help Committee on paid family leave for working families. Now, President Biden's proposal includes $1.8 trillion in the American Families Plan, subsidizing universal child care for up to 12 weeks of paid family and medical leave, and expanded child tax credits. Here's Democratic Senator Maggie Hassan.
According to a report by AARP and the National Alliance for Caregiving, more than 21% of adults reported caring for an adult or a child in the previous 12 months. The majority of adults who have both a job and caregiving responsibilities reported making at least one change in their employment, such as cutting back work hours, taking a leave of absence, or leaving their job entirely to care for a loved one. The demand for caregiving is likely to only grow as our population is aging. So how do you believe that access to paid caregiving leave will benefit workers, their families, and our entire economy?
Thank you so much for the question, Senator Hassan. You know, it's interesting that you asked this question. There was a study that came out just yesterday in the National Bureau of Economic Research showing that when caregivers have access to paid family leave, when a spouse has an injury and can't be working anymore, the paid family leave is correlated with more workforce retention for caregivers. And that's consistent with research from California as well, which shows labor force impact for working family caregivers who have access to paid leave, both in the short term and the long term. So if you think about it this way, you are in a family, there is a serious health condition, your child might have a disability, your child might get sick, might have cancer, you need to be able to be there with them in the hospital. The child will recover faster, the child or the person with special needs will get the care that they need, the person who is ill will get better faster, there are fewer medical complications, and the caregiver can either get back to work, or if long-term care is needed, they can help find a paid caregiver, and that's another piece of the care economy we need to pay attention to, a paid caregiver to help. You know, these are families, these are people who are working middle-class jobs, low-wage jobs. They're doing everything they can to put food on the table, to keep paying the rent. Paid leave is a support that helps that. It helps people be financially independent. It helps them continue to work. It helps them to have higher earnings over time. And it's beneficial to caregivers, care recipients, businesses who don't have to bear the costs of turnover, who don't have to look for new workers, and the economy overall.
Today's Senate hearing is available on our website at cspan.org. Veronique DeRougie is a senior research fellow at the Mercatus Center at George Mason University. I want to go back to the issue of using the tax code for child care issues and tax benefits for families. The White House saying this will benefit as many as 39 million American families. You say it's not a good idea to use the tax code to solve social problems. Why?
So it's not transparent, for one thing. When you look at the budget, you have to look at a special table called tax expenditures. It's not a subsidy that has to be reauthorized, and that is really visible on budget. The other thing is tax credits really end up having are problematic in the sense that they make the tax code even more complicated than it already is by carving the base, you know, like Swiss cheese. And in the end, it creates a lot of distortions without the academic research has shown creating actually that much economic growth. And it creates also a lot of unfairness because in the end, you know, if you have an understanding that your people making relatively the same amount of money should be actually paying the same amount. This tax credits of all sorts, because there's a tax credit for children, there's a tax credit depending on whether you have you know, a house. I mean, there's interest deduction if you own a mortgage and to deduct your interest. There's all sorts of things. Then really, ultimately, the amount of taxes you pay really depend on the choices that you make. And that's why we call it social engineering through the tax code.
You're a parent. The administration says it wants to deal with the high cost of raising children, especially with child care. So if not the tax code, what are the solutions?
So They are. I mean, actually, so at the federal level, it's harder. But at the state and local level, there's a ton of things. So, for instance, we know for a fact that one of the things that makes child care horribly expensive is all the requirements that are imposed through occupational licensing. We have a crazy system now where in order to be able to be getting a license to take care of children, you have to have a degree. You have to go through some training. Now there are people who are saying you have to actually go to college and get a special degree. You have to have, if you're going to be a daycare center, you need to have a certain number of space, parking requirements, all those sorts of things that actually end up making the cost of childcare really expensive. And that's just one of the many tax regulatory burden that end up making child rearing just really expensive. I mean, before we start handing out a massive amount of money, because here we're talking about massive amount of money, all the way to $300, $600, no strings attached for people who basically don't pay any taxes for a lot of taxpayers, including high-income taxpayers. So before we start doing this, let's actually remove all the regulatory barriers that make the cost of childcare more expensive.
But would you not argue that some of those regulations are designed to make sure that the child is safe and in proper hands?
I absolutely agree that this is the reason why it is done. But there's a level of regulatory accumulation that that means that at some point the safety argument doesn't apply. The parking requirements, which makes it much more expensive if you're going to have a child care center. They absolutely do not increase the safety. And there are actually different forces that that act against one another. And I think the literature is just actually kind of very unclear about really whether those really provide more safety. I mean, just marginally some of them do, but there's a point where really it doesn't anymore.
Veronique DeRuggi, she is a nationally syndicated columnist, also a senior research fellow at the Mercatus Center at George Mason University. Thank you for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
And now to the latest in the Middle East, as the bloodshed continues in Israel and the Gaza Strip. A week of fighting leaving more than 200 people dead in Israel and the occupied territories. Most of those who have died, including more than 60 children, are Palestinians. The New York Times has this headline this evening. Biden is said to have taken a firmer line in his call with Netanyahu. Here are some of the details from the New York Times. Quote, President Biden today delivering a firmer message in private to the Israeli prime minister than he's done so in public, warning that he could put off growing pressure from the international community and from Congress for only so long. He wants a change in Israel's approach to Hamas. The New York Times goes on to write the private message hinting at a time limit for President Biden's ability to provide diplomatic cover for the actions of the Israeli government, as well as a new dynamic in American politics. The president presenting himself as a closer friend to Israel than Israel may find in Congress. Well, in remarks earlier today, the former Secretary of State Mike Pompeo with these comments, the event sponsored by the Center for Security Policy.
The Trump administration was still within that framework, but it did understand that it didn't really have to choose between the Israelis and the Arabs, that actually being pro-Israeli helped with other Arabs as well, and that it improved a regional climate that led to peace, despite what the current administration's press office is saying, that these were empty peace treaties. They were actually very genuine moves forward in creating a regional climate of peace. But that said, at the core, we never really got anywhere with the two-state solution. Do you think we should continue along that path in a slightly different way, or do you think we need to start thinking creatively about different possible solutions?
Yeah, David, I think the solution that we proposed was actually different. You'll note that the 70th Secretary of State didn't commute between Jerusalem and Ramallah, trying to figure out where some line on a map would be, trying to negotiate some technical outcome, which essentially has to follow an ideological commitment from the Palestinians that says, no, it's acceptable that there will at least be one state called Israel. Right? This ideology, you can't walk away from this while they cling. And if you look at the covenants that Hamas has in place, and you look at, until they acknowledge that Israel has a right to exist, there's no map making. There's nothing to really hold on to. We proposed something that was inside the traditional framework in terms of a two-state solution, but acknowledged that those two states would be radically different. We would give maximum autonomy to the Palestinians in the West Bank every place that we could. We would ensure that they had the ability to have jobs and work and roads that were there and security and privacy for their own people. All of those things we could deliver. And I'm convinced that the Israelis would have, when they sat down and had conversations with the Palestinians, would have been able to deliver as well. But that Israel was going to need to maintain the capacity to defend itself. And you can see today precisely why Israel will never give that up.
Those comments earlier today from former Secretary of State Mike Pompeo. Natan Sachs is the director of the Center for Middle East Policy at Brookings here in Washington. A piece that he recently posted has this headline, "The Perfect Storm for Israelis and Palestinians." Let's get some background. How did Israel, how did Hamas reach this point?
It's good to be with you, Steve. I think, you know, what we're seeing is really a confluence of many different factors coming in, and that's part of the tragedy, part of what makes this round especially difficult. We saw a long-standing dispute where Israelis, Jewish Israelis, were claiming land that Jews had owned before 1948, so before the establishment of the State of Israel, before the War of 1948, in what is now East Jerusalem and what became Sheikh Jarrah, a largely Palestinian neighborhood. They were applying to the courts to get this property back under a law that allows Jews to do so. Of course, Palestinians would like to do the same with a massive amount, a huge number of refugees who left what became Israel in 1948 and are barred from doing the same. This became the focus of a great dispute in Jerusalem around Sheikh Jarrah with a lot of international attention. But at the same time, during Ramadan, which just came to a close, we saw tensions around Damascus Gate, which is one of the gates of the old city of Jerusalem, not far from Sheikh Jarrah. And there we saw Palestinian youth who gathered, especially at the end of the fast, the daily fast during the month of Ramadan, and police, which is stationed there, really almost nightly clashes. And before too long, that spread to what Jews call Temple Mount, what Muslims call Haram al-Sharif, which is where the Al-Aqsa Mosque is. We saw demonstrations there as well, and the police was trying to stop stone throwing and other things, and in what I describe as an astoundingly bad decision, enter the mosque and even use stun grenades inside the mosque. The mosque is a very central one in the Muslim world and really kind of a symbol of Islam, certainly in Jerusalem. So that reverberated around the world. All this together gave an opening for Hamas, which is barely present in Jerusalem or the West Bank, but gave an opening for Hamas to try and claim the mantle of defender of Jerusalem, and especially of the mosque. Hamas is a religious movement. And it shot six rockets toward Jerusalem in sort of a warning towards Israel about these events. And then conflict began with huge salvos of rockets from Gaza, especially towards Tel Aviv, with improved range and improved tactics of firing them. And that's how we got to this very bloody moment of Israel striking Hamas in the Gaza Strip with many civilian dead and Hamas shooting hundreds and hundreds, now well over 1,000 rockets towards Israeli cities.
This one sentence really kind of summarizes where we are at. Quote, "As bad as the previous rounds were, the past few weeks have managed to touch and inflame almost every core aspect of the century-old Israeli-Palestinian conflict. You talk about national narratives and grievances, religious sanctity and symbols, and communal violence not seen in decades." Can you explain?
Yeah, so the national element there is indeed the refugees. The inhabitants who now live in these homes in Sheikh Jarrah are themselves refugees from what became Israel. And, of course, Israel is trying to reclaim, or not Israel, but individuals are trying to reclaim these homes, again, in the name of some kind of right of return, although it's a selective right of return that they're trying to use. And very quickly, it turned to religious symbols. The strongest, most deep-held religious symbols around Al-Aqsa Mosque. And these two ingredients have long inflamed this conflict and have characterized different aspects of it and even different parties and Palestinian organizations, where Fatah more the nationalists and Hamas more the religious, of course. And then added to that, this violence and the confluence of these symbols has also brought about something unprecedented, which I mentioned there, which is communal violence, even inside Israel itself, in mixed towns and mixed cities where both Jews and Arabs live. This is something that we haven't seen in many decades, perhaps since 1949, where you see residents fearing each other. This shouldn't be overstated. Most of Israel is very functional, of course, and quiet is already mostly restored. But the scenes we did see of lynches and mobs in various directions, with the police barely keeping a lid on things, this is something that was new and very frightening for Israelis, and showed a blurring of what's often known as the green line that separates between Israel and the West Bank on the one side and Gaza on the other. That was the border of Israel, not really a border, but the armistice line that defined Israel after 1949 and until 1967. There's a blurring there. Just now, we saw a big strike of Palestinians, and that was a strike where Palestinians stopped working in the West Bank, but also in East Jerusalem and inside Israel, and of course in the Gaza Strip. So a solidarity strike across all these different territories, that's new. That's quite different.
Bottom line, is there an end game for Hamas, for the Palestinians, for the Israeli government?
Not much of one, which I think is really perhaps the most tragic aspect of all. None of the parties is really working here to try to fundamentally change the equation. In the past, Hamas has often launched rockets with demands regarding the Gaza Strip, in particular to lift or ease the blockade that Israel has on the Gaza Strip, where it tries to prevent Hamas from acquiring material that it would then use to, for example, build tunnels. Israel is now targeting dozens of kilometers of tunnels, very expensive tunnels that Hamas has built under cities and towns in the Gaza Strip, and that's where it mostly operates from. This is the kind of thing that Israel is trying to prevent with this blockade, but of course the damage of the blockade for 2 million Gazans is enormous. We've already seen 15 years now with 2 million people growing up not only under Hamas rule, but with almost no contact with the outside world, with Israel and also Egypt on the southern border of the Gaza Strip blockading it. But that's not a demand that we've seen from Hamas this time. This time, Hamas has been making demands about Jerusalem, things that are very far from its control and upon which Israel is not going to give in to Hamas. On the other hand, the Palestinian Authority seems to be at a dead end. The Palestinian Authority was going to hold elections. There was some chance that Hamas would even win. And before this violence began, the Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas canceled those elections. This may have also contributed to Hamas's desire and need to find some kind of other outlet and other way to go back to center stage, since it did not have the elections to do so. And Israel, for its part, Israel would love, in an ideal world, that the Gaza Strip change fundamentally, that Hamas evaporate somehow. But Hamas is not evaporating, and the Israelis know this. And they have long since given up on the hope that Gazans would spontaneously rise up against Hamas. It would be an extremely hard thing to do in the Gaza Strip. It's very small, very armed. Hamas has an iron grip there. And so Israel, in a sense, is trying to come back to more or less the status quo ante. It says, and it also means, that it would like to improve somewhat the conditions in the Gaza Strip. It has worked toward that, in fact, with Hamas and with help of others just in the past 2 years. But these are not huge changes. This would not entail, at least in the foreseeable future, a dramatic change in the conditions, be it in Gaza or in the West Bank or anywhere else. So part of what makes this round especially troubling is that if we reach a ceasefire, and I hope that happens as soon as possible, it does not probably portend any major change to the conditions that led to this in the first place.
We are talking with the director of the Center for Middle East Policy at the Brookings Institution here in Washington, D.C., Natan Sachs. Thank you for being with us.
It's my pleasure. Thank you very much for having me.
And a reminder, this program, Washington Today, it's available as a podcast. Be sure to listen and follow wherever you get your favorite podcast. I'm Steve Scully with the Tuesday edition of Washington Today. Hoping you enjoy the rest of your evening.